So, good afternoon. So, we continue now with... Okay, so we continue with the next nun to lift her voice. This is Dhammadina. Does anyone not have a copy? Everybody has a copy? If you don't have a copy, I have a copy and I'm using this text, so if you would like a copy, you can have.
And I think they should be outside on the table.
Is it?
I think so.
Are there still some left?
I think so. Otherwise, I can give him one from the office.
So, Dhammadina was praised as the nun foremost in the gift of preaching, sharing the Dharma. And so this shows us that even at the time of the Buddha, it was also nuns who went and gave teaching, not only amongst themselves, but also within the lay community. So Dhammadina was known for this. The Buddha himself praised her as foremost in preaching. Did you find good? So, Dhammadina was the wife of a prominent citizen of Rajgir. Rajgir is nearby Bodh Gaya. It's not far from Bodh Gaya. The husband went to hear the Buddha preach and came back silent and ignored his wife. At last, he said, "I want to be a monk." And so he promised that he would leave all his wealth to his wife. He said, "Please give me permission to leave home." And so Dhammadina said, "Well, if you're going to leave home, then I want to leave home too." So she went to the community of nuns, therefore, and after ordination, she practiced assiduously and she very soon became realized. Later, she returned to Rajgir and discovered that her husband had changed his mind about being a monk. However, he put his questions to her on the Dharma, on meditation, and on Nirvana, and she answered easily and said that since his questions were endless, he should seek out the Buddha himself. So he did so, and then he repeated what he had said, his dialogue with Dhammadina, his questions, her answers. He repeated all this to the Buddha. And the Buddha commended her answers and said that he himself would have answered in just the same way. So, therefore, Dhammadina's responses were designated as Buddha Vachana, as the word of the Buddha, which is an extraordinary honor. In the canon itself, her replies were regarded as if it were the Buddha himself saying this. So this dialogue which she had is preserved in the Majjhima Nikaya of the Pali Canon. So we don't have too much of what she said, but This is the verse which she spoke at the time of her enlightenment. She who has given rise to the wish for freedom and is set on it shall be clear in mind. One whose heart is not caught in the pleasure of the senses and who is bound upstream will be freed. So there she is just putting it very carefully, what we need, what are the prerequisites for gaining freedom is the desire for freedom and the determination to attain it. And that should be very clear. The point with these women was that they did not compromise. They set, as one might say, their GPS on the go, and off they went. And they didn't do any detours. They hardly stopped for petrol. They just went on until they got there. So one whose heart is not caught in the pleasure of the senses, this comes up again, don't get distracted. The delights, the bliss of nirvana negates all worldly happiness. Compared with that, worldly happiness is just tawdry, nothing. So don't get distracted. And then if, because of one's determination and one's total focus on the goal, one is bound upstream, we remember the Buddha said that someone practicing Dharma sincerely is like a fish going upstream when the rest of the shoal are going downstream. So, one who is bound upstream, having entered the stream, they then go on, once return, another returner, never returner. An arhat then, that one who is bound upstream will be freed. So that's Dhammadina. I don't know what happened to her husband. You see, he vacillated. He compromised. He didn't go forth like she did. He inspired her to go forth, but then he got cold feet. And so he's probably still revolving in samsara. And she's out. Take the opportunity while it presents itself. Kama. The famous Kama of modern times is Aya Kama, who was a German nun who was ordained way back when. I mean, I think in the 60s. I met her one time in Assisi. She came to Assisi and we went round Assisi together doing all the pilgrimage places. She was very nice. We had great fun. But she was she started a retreat center for women in Sri Lanka. And she especially emphasized entry into the jhanas, and which at that time was still in the West regarded as something unattainable now in these modern times. But she, like Pa Ok and others in Burma, said, no, that's not true, that actually the jhanas are not so difficult if you have the right external conditions and the right internal determination, that actually one can get into the jhanas not very difficultly. There is this nun, Burmese nun, who actually has been in America, called Sayele Dipankara, and she says that you definitely can get into jhanas within 10 days. So, have you tried?
She did all eight jhanas, I think, in 1 week, yeah?
Yeah, well, she I think, went into samadhi by the age of 4. So she's one of those. And she might not appreciate the difficulties the rest of us have. But she says that she can get anybody, if they are determined, into jhanas within 10 days. So her attitude, likewise, is that it's really not impossible. Really, one can do it if one has conducive circumstances and the right teaching the right training in how to do this. So Ayakema in her day was a big inspiration, especially for women. And her books are very nice also and very helpful. She was very a good person. And anyway, so she was a modern Kema, but this is the old Kema from whom she was named. And the Arahati Kema, was foremost in great wisdom and the most exemplary nun. She is held up as the model of what a nun could be. So she is therefore well known for her being a very, very excellent nun. So Kema, she came from a royal family of Mada and was very beautiful. Many of these women were very beautiful. They're again and again, we are informed that they were beautiful. I'm not sure how much in the Theragata they emphasize how handsome the monks were. Who wrote the books? Anyway, this was another beautiful one. with the corresponding, therefore, their reply to being always told how beautiful they were, which was their weariness with their beauty and the, you know, emphasis on the unbeautiful aspects of the body. Don't get caught up in externals, they're saying. So anyway, she was from a royal family of Mada and very beautiful and became the chief consort of King Bimbisara. Now, Bimbisara was a great devotee of the Buddha and one of his first early supporters. He was a very devout king. He had a not very happy end, which we won't go into, but he himself was very devout and nice king. His son wasn't so good, as often happens in these families. Anyway, she was the chief consort of the king, so she was a queen. And she was very vain and did not want to meet with the Buddha because he spoke against pleasure of the senses and beauty of the body. So rather like Sundari Nanda, she was frightened to meet the Buddha because she knew that he would be dispelling all her attachments to pleasure and beauty and so forth, and she didn't want to hear it. However, she heard a song about the loveliness of the grove where the Buddha lived, so she wanted to see that. Many of his more affluent supporters would offer land on which the monks could build simple huts. Originally, the monks, as I say, were all on the road, and they had no permanent dwelling at all. They were just always staying on the outskirts of the towns. In those days, India, of course, was all jungle, right? Not like now. In those days, India was mostly jungle with just small towns scattered from here to there. And so the monks would come into the town for alms in the early morning, but otherwise they were just wandering through the jungle paths, rather like the Thai forest monks, living mostly just quietly under trees. But then in India, they have a very heavy monsoon season, which starts in June and goes on sometimes to October, certainly till September. And during that time, it's pouring with rain. And so it was difficult for the monks traveling around and sleeping under trees when day after day, week after week, month after month, it was pouring with rain. And in addition, the lay people said it's not good that monks are traveling at that time because they could be treading down the rice saplings, which is what they grow during the monsoon. During the monsoon, they plant all the rice, which needs lots of water. And also they could be killing insects at that time, because many insects likewise get washed out, and as they're walking along, they might step on an insect unwittingly. And as I say, also walking along through the fields, they would be destroying the rice crop. So the lay people asked the Buddha, please, could during the rainy season, could we construct some simple huts, maybe of bamboo, and that during the rainy season, the monks could just stay there as the Jains did, they said. As the Jains have a time for staying quietly during monsoon, then the monks also could do this. And then the monks also thought, this is a very good idea, because then we can just stay quietly and do our practice. And the lay people guaranteed that they would give alms and keep the monks fed. So in the beginning, that's what they did. After a few years of wandering, then they started to settle just for monsoon. And then, of course, the inevitable, that was really quite nice. And also the lay people liked having the monks around. They got to know them. And they said, well, if the monks stay here, they can give us teaching. We will support the monks. This makes a lot more sense than endlessly wandering around. So more and more monks began to settle. So more and more huts came up. And that, of course, was the beginning of the settled monastic system of having monasteries where monks would stay. So, therefore, people knowing that now, you know, these groups of monks needed somewhere to stay, they began to offer land to the Buddha. And there they began to build their huts. So there are many famous sites still in India where there was donated land, which later they built monasteries and in occasionally nunneries. In Vaishali, which was where Mahaprajapati went to ask the Buddha after he had refused her again, to accept them, and that's where they got ordained. In Vaishali, there are the ruins of probably the most ancient Buddhist nunnery. It's still there. And then in Shravasti, in the Jetta Grove, which was offered to the Buddha by a wealthy merchant called Anathapindika, again, there are ruins, of course, not back to the time of the Buddha, but nonetheless very ancient ruins of monasteries there, and said to be the kutir where the Buddha himself lived. He spent 25 years in Shravasti. And likewise, all around in that part of India are these sites of the very, very early Buddhist monasteries. To give them credit, the Archaeological Society of India maintain them very nicely. They turn them into parks with the ruins in embedded in the parks. So they're very nice. And then various countries, Buddhist countries, build what are called dharmsalas, which means like guest houses for pilgrims. And so there are various, especially Sri Lankan, Burmese, and now Vietnamese, Japanese, and so forth, around the perimeters, they build up these places for pilgrims when they come to these sacred places to be able to stay. Why am I talking about this? Who knows? Because she had heard there was some poem or song about one particular one of these groves, and so they were probably praising how calm it was, how beautiful, how pleasant the trees, and so forth. And so she was attracted by beauty and pleasure, so she thought she'd just skip in there and take a look. Little did she know. So anyway, so she heard a song about the loveliness of the grove where the Buddha lived. So she went to take a look. And of course the Buddha knew, naturally. So he conjured up again, as with Sundari Nanda, he conjured up a vision of a goddess who was far more beautiful than Kama. And then before her eyes, the image aged until it became an old hag. And the Buddha said, people devoted to physical beauty are bound to the world. Those who renounce are free. So seeing this, which must have been, if you saw it in front of you happening, Kama realized impermanence, and she at that moment entered the stream. So she was already heading upstream now. Then she left the harem, and she became a nun. Later, she also gave teaching to King Pasenadi, a devotee of the Buddha. I mean, she was a queen, so therefore, you know, she had the confidence to teach Dharma even to kings. Her verses are a dialogue with Mara, dealing with contempt for the body and sensual pleasure. Now, Mara is an interesting one. I am very fond of Mara on many levels. He's sometimes quite funny. Mara, well, I mean, he's described as a Buddhist Satan. But really, he represents everything which is in opposition to, inimical to enlightenment. The Buddha had many dialogues with him, even after his enlightenment. He's always popping up. You will remember at the time of the, just prior to the Buddha's enlightenment, when he was sitting under the tree in Bodh Gaya, Mara called up his forces. First, he sent his beautiful daughters to seduce the Buddha, or at least distract him. But of course, as we know, I mean, the Buddha had been brought up in a harem, so he was hardly likely to be interested in Mara's daughters. So then, that really represents greed and desire, sensual desire. But the Bodhisattva was beyond sensual desire. He wasn't interested in that. So then, Mara presented fear in the form of his army. So traditionally, it's shown as all these warriors on elephants are standing with their bows and arrows. So they're shooting their arrows at the Buddha. He's sitting under his tree, and then suddenly all these elephants and soldiers with their arrows shooting at the Buddha in order to arouse anger or to arouse fear. But, of course, the Buddha responded by sending loving kindness. And so all those arrows transformed into flowers, which created that aura around the Buddha. Because in the face of our internal fears, all our traumatic memories or our fear of losing ego or any fear which comes up psychologically or externally, the answer is welcome, acceptance, and loving kindness. In the face of that, fear dissolves and transforms. So then Mara, of course, said to the Buddha, you have no right to attain. You have no right to go beyond my realm. This whole world is my realm. Who gave you the right to go beyond my realm? And that's when the Buddha put down his hand and touched the earth, and the earth goddess arose and said that because of the Bodhisattva's exemplary virtue in so many past lifetimes, he had the right, he owned that piece of ground, and he had the right to attain enlightenment on that piece of ground, which is one of the reasons why Bodh Gaya is considered such a sacred place, because that place is where there is the permission to go beyond. So this is why the Buddha is shown usually with his hand down, right? He's calling the earth to witness his right to become a Buddha. So Mara at that point gave up and toddled off. But later he comes back again and again and again to challenge the Buddha and the Buddha's disciples. At the end, he comes about 3 months before the Buddha is going to pass on into Mahaparinirvana. And he says to the Buddha, well, look here, you've done everything now. The fourfold Sangha. The Buddha, before he said to the Buddha, shortly after his enlightenment, you can go now, you're enlightened. And the Buddha said, no, Mara, I cannot leave until I have established a fourfold Sangha. So if he was right from the start planning on the fourfold Sangha, how can you say he didn't want nuns? Because nuns are part of that fourfold Sangha. And then at the end, towards just before the Buddha passed into Mahaparinirvana, again Mara came and said, now the fourfold Sangha is well established and flourishing. You can go now. And the Buddha said, yes, I'm going. Don't worry. Don't be in a hurry. I'm leaving. Now my fourfold Sangha is well established. Now I can leave. So, I mean, the point is that again and again the Buddha goes on about this fourfold Sangha. So how can you say that he didn't want, he only wanted a threefold Sangha? Because he compares it to a table which has four legs and is therefore very stable. So all through his ministry, he talked about the fourfold Sangha and the importance of the fourfold Sangha. So, I mean, I don't see how he could suddenly have changed his mind halfway through and decided, well, you know, a fourfold Sangha sounds better than threefold anyway, thanks to Ananda. He must have known. He was omniscient. Anyway, Mara appears again and again. Mara is that voice of opposition. Mara is that voice which, when we make a decision, a virtuous decision, then comes along and says, yes, but I don't know if we should do that. You know, maybe not quite that. Yes, we see, there's going to be a retreat. And we think, yes, right, I must go on that retreat. And then Mara comes and says, yeah, but can you afford it? And really, you know, there's not that much time. And, you know, your daughter in such and such really would like to see, you know, her mother. So why not do that retreat now? You can do the retreat later, another time. Right now, let's use that money to go off somewhere and see somebody else. That's Mara. So the way to deal with Mara, who is always coming up with bright ideas of how to avoid doing what we know we should be doing, is to say, I know you, Mara. That's all they say. I know you, Mara. And as soon as Mara is recognized, plop, disappears. Or slinks off. It's a bit like a pantomime demon. You know, if the good witch comes and waggles her wand, he slunks out through the side wings. So it's sort of like that. The thing with Mara is not to oppose him, not to argue with him even, but to know him. As soon as we recognize that voice inside, which is trying to detract us from where we know we should be going, from what we know we should be doing, as soon as we recognize it, then it has no power to influence us. As long as we don't recognize it, then we just keep going along and we're sidetracked once more. So Mara comes up all the time in the Pali Canon and also in the Mahayana Canon, because in our lives always, no matter our best intentions, there is always the other side who is suggesting, well, maybe not right now. In the shamanic side of Tibetan Buddhism, they have the idea that we all have a good spirit on the right side and a bad spirit on the left side, and they're both whispering in our ears, right? And depending whether we listen to the right-hand spirit, the good spirit, or the bad spirit, they gain more and more power. So this is very true. The more we give in to our lower instincts or our lower ambitions, then the stronger they become, the stronger Mara becomes. And the more we repudiate that and recognize Mara for what he is, the stronger becomes our ability to make the right decisions and stay straight on the path. So Mara comes here. And so Mara says to Kema, "You are young and beautiful." He comes as a handsome young man. He often, for the boys, he comes as a beautiful woman. For the nuns, he appears as a handsome young guy. "Hi, Kema." So he says, "You are young and beautiful, and so am I. Come, Kema, let's enjoy each other and make music together." Kema is not having any of that. "This foul body, sick, so easily broken, vexes and shames me. My craving for sex," or sensual pleasure, really, it's, you know, he translates it as sex, "has been rooted out. The pleasures of sex are like swords and stakes. The body, senses, and the mind, just the chopping block on which they cut. What you call the delights of sensual pleasure are no delight for me now. What you take as pleasure are not for me. The mass of mental darkness is split open. Know this, evil one. You are defeated. You are finished. You honor the stars and look to them for guidance. You tend the fire in the forest." Now she's talking about Brahmin priests, actually. "Fools, you thought that all that could be relied on, while all the while not knowing what really is. But I honor the Buddha, best of all men. By doing what the Buddha taught, I am freed from all sufferings." So again, this question that if we rely only on the pleasures of the senses and on our attachment to our physical beauty, then we will not find the path. That the path is very straightforward. They are like arrows facing straight without... I mean, if we fire an arrow from a bow, it goes straight to the target. It doesn't detour. Chung. And so that's how they were with their determination. They knew what they wanted. At that time, the idea of becoming an arhati and of attaining nirvana was very close, because so many had attained. So they had the examples before them. Probably their teachers were arhatis. So it's not like something you read in a book. They had so many examples in front of them, apart from the Buddha himself. So it was a very attainable goal for them. It wasn't just something which they heard talked about. They had examples right in front of them of people who had done this and had attained. Apart from, as I say, the extraordinary privilege of being able to hear the Buddha himself speak, which must have had indeed an incredible impact on anyone who had the karma, of course, to be in his presence. So there was the Buddha, he had all these arahats around him. The first 60 monks who joined the Sangha were all arhats. At one point, the Buddha says to, I don't know, Ananda or Shariputra or somebody, he says, do you remember the good old days when there were only 60 of us and we were all arhats and there were no rules? They didn't need rules because they were arhats. And an arahat, being egoless, is totally beyond the mental defilements. And so they didn't need rules. I mean, everything they thought, said, and did was completely in conformity with the highest truth. So they didn't need to have rules. But then, as Buddhism spread and became more and more popular, then, of course, all different kinds of people joined the order. And by no means all of them became arhats. In fact, many of them seemed to spend their life trying to devise ways to be naughty. And so then, you know, the Buddha made these rules, and then the lay people would come and complain. And so then he made another rule, and then somebody else would complain about that, and so then he made another rule. And in the end, we end up with hundreds of rules. And this is why the Buddha said, now we've got so many rules, and everybody's so busy trying to break them. Oh, do you remember when there were just 60 of us and we were all rule-free? So, at that time, there were many examples of the holy life well lived. There were many, many arhats. There were many, many arhati. And so therefore these women coming into contact with this were deeply inspired. And they could see very clearly that if they really dropped everything, they would attain, because so many around them had attained. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why when they speak, they are so totally uncompromising. Because they knew if they really went for it straight, they could gain liberation in this very lifetime, sometimes very quickly. Of course, they think very quickly also because you needed to have incredible karma to have been born at that time. I mean, everything now is it's farther and farther away, and it's all got a bit diluted, and it's harder to see with clarity and conviction where to go, how to go. But at that time, it was still red hot, white hot. The Buddha was still there. All these arahats, all these arahatis. Incredible intensity. And this is why so many of them, plugging into that, were just illuminated so quickly, freed, released. So anyway, Mara was very strong because all the light brings in also the darkness. But undoubtedly, it was a very exciting time when so much was happening in that area. And so many beings were being liberated at that time. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why they don't in any way compromise. They never compromise. They're just straight for the goal, and that's it. Nothing is going to cause them to detour. So, the next one is another Subha. This is Subha of the Jiva Kampa Grove. She again was born into a wealthy Brahmin family in Rajgir. Most of them were in the same area. If you know anything about India, the Buddha really walked around in a very circumscribed area of northeast India, called Magadha. And he didn't go beyond that. Of course, if you go to Burma or Thailand, there are all these nice big footprints where the Buddha landed. But we can take that as being his Sambhogakaya. So he kept within his area because, of course, they were walking. And also there were jungles. And so they could not have, you know, it's not like superhighways. They were walking slowly, slowly. Wherever he met someone who wished to dialogue, they would stop and have a dialogue. When he reached towns, then people would gather so that the monks or the Buddha himself would give teachings. And that was their life. They weren't trying to get anywhere. They were just going, wandering from place to place to place. And the only time they really had a destination was during the rainy season, where they had to have an allotted place to stay for the months of the rainy season. Otherwise, they were on the road. So, this Subha also was born into a wealthy Brahmin family in Rajgir. She was likewise beautiful and therefore called Subha, which means beautiful. She saw the Buddha on one occasion when he was visiting Rajgir. So then she had great faith and she was ordained by Mahaprajapati and she quickly made progress towards liberation. So this is what happens when she met up with a young man who was, again, very taken with her, you know, because she was very beautiful. And of course, a lot of the men, again, were very insulted that, especially the pretty ones, actually renounced them. How dare they? And so they were always very... trying to seduce these nuns back into the worldly life again. But of course, these nuns weren't having anything to do with it. So, as the nun Subha entered the beautiful Jivakamba grove, a rake grabbed her. And Subha said this to him, "Friend, it is not right for a man to touch a woman who has gone forth. Why do you keep me from my way? I am in a pure state without blemish. It is the discipline taught by the Sugata, the teacher's instruction that I revere. Why do you keep me from my way? Your mind is disturbed. Mine is not. You are impure. I am not. My mind is free wherever I am. Why do you keep me from my way?" So the rake replies, "You are young and innocent. How can going forth be right for you? Come on, get rid of that yellow robe. Let's enjoy each other in this forest, its flowers all in bloom. The air is sweet. The trees are erect. Their pollen is everywhere. Come on. The beginning of spring is a season of happiness. Let's enjoy each other in this forest, its flowers all in bloom. The trees are covered in flowers, like body hairs standing on end. They seem to moan in pleasure when the breeze blows. What delights of love there will be for you if you go into the forest. What delights of love will there be for you if you go into the forest all by yourself? You want to go into the vast forest without a girlfriend. It's frightening and lonely, filled with herds of wild beasts. It echoes with the choruses of female elephants excited by a male. Aha! You will stand out, wandering about in the forest, like a doll of gleaming gold, or like a beautiful nymph in Chitarata. What should I call you when nothing compares to you? You are exquisite, so lovely, in those good clothes and with your fine Kasi shawl. I would be at your... Kasi is Varanasi. Varanasi was very famous for its cloth. It still is very famous for its cloth. I would be at your command if we were to live together in the forest. No one is more dear to me than you, lady with the bashful eyes of a Kinari. If you do what I suggest, you will be happy. Come, make a home with me. You will live in the safety of a palace. Let women wait on you. Wrap yourself in these Kasi shawls. Put on some makeup and perfume while I get all sorts of adornments, gold, gems, and pearls for you. Climb into this new bed. It's so luxurious. It's sweet-smelling from sandalwood. Beautiful. It has spreads, throws, and covers, and above it is a pure white canopy. Or, Holy One, would you rather go to old age with your body untouched, like a blue lotus that rises from the water but is untouched by human hands? So, Suba, it's probably... God, he goes on. She says, you really are out of your mind. What is it that you see when you look at this body, filled as it is with things that have already died, destined as it is to fall apart only to fill a cemetery? So the rake says, I see your eyes. They are like the eyes of a fawn. They are like the eyes of a Kinari in a mountain cave. Seeing your eyes only increases my delight in getting ready to make love to you. Those eyes, seeing them like blue lotus buds on your golden face, only increases my desire in getting ready to make love to you. Even after you have gone far away, I will remember you and your eyes, your long eyelashes, your pure gaze, lady with the bashful eyes of a Kinari. There is nothing better than your eyes. So Suba says, you lust after a daughter of the Buddha. You must want to go where no one else has gone. Want the moon as a toy and want to jump over Mount Meru too. In this world with its gods, there is nothing that I desire. If something I would desire exists, I do not know what it is. Whatever it may be, the path of my teacher has destroyed the urge for it down to the root. I do not see that there could be anything worth desiring. The path has destroyed the urge for things down to the root. If something does exist that I might feel an urge for, the urge for it is like an ember that jumps from a fire pit only to go out, like a bowl of poison that evaporates untouched. There may be people who have not thought things through. Maybe there are others who have not seen the teacher. You should lust after one of them. But try to seduce someone who knows, and you will suffer. My mindfulness stays firm in the middle of scolding and praising. Happiness and suffering, knowing that what is constructed is foul, my mind does not get stuck anywhere. I am a disciple of the Sugata, traveling in the vehicle that can only go on the Eightfold Path. The dart is pulled out. The depravities that ooze from within are wasted away. I am happy that I have gone to a deserted place. I have seen painted dolls and puppets dancing about, held up and held together by sticks and strings. When the sticks and strings are cut, let go of, thrown away and scattered, broken into bits that can't be seen, what would you fix your mind on there? My body parts are like that. They don't exist without smaller bits, and the body itself doesn't exist without those parts. So what would you fix your mind on there? You saw some figures painted on a wall, colored with yellow that makes their bodies seem lifelike. But what you saw is the opposite of what you think. You thought you saw humans when none are there. Blind one, you run after things that are not there, things that are like a magician's illusion or a tree of gold seen in a dream. Eyes are just little balls in various shapes. With its tears, an eye is a bubble of water between the eyelids, like a small ball of lac in the hollow of a tree, and milky mucus comes out of it. So then, spoken by those who compiled the scriptures, then the one who was so pleasing to look at, that is Subha, her mind unattached and with no regard for her eyes, gorged it out and gave it to that man, saying, "Here, take the eye, it's yours." His sexual passion ended right there. His sexual passion ended right there forever. And he begged her forgiveness, saying, "Holy one, be whole again. This won't happen again." Wronging a person is like embracing fire. It's as if I handled a poisonous snake. Be whole again and forgive me. That nun who was freed then went to the Buddha, and when she saw the beautiful signs of the excellence of his body, her eye became whole again as it was before. So, and that's a very graphic description of the problem. But I think there's this point which it's making is that he was very obsessed by her beauty and especially by the beauty of her eyes. And, you know, many people, when they fall in love or imagine that they've fallen in love, they zero in on certain physical characteristics of the beloved. And, you know, then inflate them as if that was something which was crucial to the person they loved, which is, we can see, actually is very insulting. If you say, "Oh, I love you, your eyes are so beautiful, I love your eyes," then, you know, well, what about the rest of that person? Not just the physical appearance, but their personality, their identity, their sense of who they are, and everything that else goes along. Their mental constituents, not just the physical constituents, which anyway are going to age and eventually die. So this is very graphically, of course, expressed by the fact he was going on and on about her beautiful eyes, so she just took it out and said, "Here you go. Now what?" And, I mean, as she described before, the eye in itself is not particularly beautiful. I mean, if we had an eye on a platter, you know, on a plate, you know, what a beautiful eye. Oh, my heart beats. I mean, hardly. So if we take that, I mean, the point is, it's what it's pointing to is clear seeing. That these things which we attach onto, if we really examine it, it's not beautiful at all. At the most, it is surface beauty. Often it's not even that. Somebody's beautiful nose, beautiful mouth, beautiful bone structure. All right, you have beautiful bone structure. Everybody's talking about, "Oh, she's really beautiful because of her bones." But if you handed them her skull, okay, this is it. This is the real thing, her bones. But we are deluded. We don't see things as they really are. We see them the way our mind covers up what is really there before us. And so, in these verses, they are uncovering. They are showing what is it that we're so obsessed with? What is it that we're so caught by? Because if we look at it with wide open eyes, the eyes of insight, we see that so many things which we think are so indispensable for our happiness are often subtly the causes of our suffering. And they saw that. That's why they were liberated. And the fact we don't see that is the reason why we are still enslaved. We are not free. And the degree to which we do not see is the degree to which we are still imprisoned. So to become liberated is a very radical step, which these nuns were very brave women. The idea that, you know, women are weak and timorous is completely blown apart by how brave these women were. They left everything behind, even in the face of strong pressure from their families and from their husbands and from society in general. Everybody was opposed to them, opposed to their leaving home. But they did it anyway. And having left home, they just set themselves straight for the goal. No compromises, no distractions, straightforward. And so they attained. They broke through. And as I said before, I mean, the important thing is to realize, what did they break through from? They didn't just break through from the delusions of this lifetime, but the idea of this endless cycle. Endless, 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 thousands and thousands of rebirths and no way out. And finally, the Buddha appeared. And they had the karma to meet him and the karma to accept his very radical path straight towards the goal of liberation. And they took it and they attained. This is why these women need to be known. They were extraordinary in any time or place. Okay, we leave it there. Then 4 o'clock, I will return if there are any questions.
And then there's group practice discussions now and yoga too with Masi and walking meditation.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.